what the appointing authority or nominating authorities look for or seemingly look for. But more importantly, we want to talk about the results of the process. What type of people are being appointed? What type of people are the appointers looking for? What are their judicial philosophies? Overall, we hope that from this panel, you'll find some useful information, especially for those who are seeking to be eventually on the bench. We have an excellent panel, and I will be brief with the bios, as we have a lot to cover. First, sitting to my immediate left, Carrie Severino is Chief Counsel and Policy Director of the Judicial Crisis Network. She's testified before Congress on assorted constitutional issues, briefed senators on judicial nominations, extensively quoted in the media, and appears regularly on MSNBC, Fox, CNN, C-SPAN, and ABC. ABC's This Week. She was previously a law clerk to United States Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and to Judge David Sentell of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. To her left, we have Professor Ryan Owens. He's a professor of political science and an affiliate faculty in the law school. He's also an honorary fellow in the Institute for Legal Studies. He works closely with the newly created Thompson Center on Public Leadership. Between 2008 and 2011, Professor Owens was an assistant professor of government at Harvard University, where he taught undergraduate and graduate students and seminars in the law school. He's regularly in the Washington Examiner, WISP Politics, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and the Washington Times. And then to far on the left, we have Katie Ignatowski, who many of you, I think, know. She's the governor's chief legal counsel. She regularly counsels the governor on issues of constitutional questions, judicial appointments, statutory interpretation. She holds degrees from Pepperdine Law School and University of Wisconsin-Madison. So thank you. Permit me to tee up the conversation here today. Of course, we'll bounce back and forth covering a number of subjects, starting with process, and moving into some of the candidates. The federal process, of course, in Wisconsin starts with a nominating commission. The members of the commission are selected by the two United States senators, make a referral to the White House, and then nominated. On the governor's side, or on the state side, I should say, the judges are filled by election. With a vacancy, there's an appointment, and then followed by an election. So with that, we will start our first topic on federal appointments in the U.S. Senate. And Ryan, I'm hoping to start with you and talk a little bit about the blue slip process and discuss your work in this area.
Okay. Well, thanks. Everybody hear me okay? All right, so the immediate post-lunch panel is always difficult. So thank you for being here. How many of you have heard about the blue slip? Raise your hand if you've heard about it. Okay, good. We have a very educated group here today. So how many of you know when the first instance of a blue slip came about? Anybody know when the first blue slip was?
1940s.
No. Do I hear anything else? Nice try, though. 1913. Okay, so the blue slip, the first time we ever saw any evidence of it was in 1913. All right, does anybody know when the Senate invoked the cloture rule? It used to be unlimited debate with a filibuster. That came about in 1917. Okay, those two dates are important. 1913 is the first use of the blue slip. 1917 is when the Senate created the cloture rule. Okay, that should tell us something about the rationale behind the origination of the blue slip. Okay, it was a way for the Senate Judiciary Chair to find out whether there was going to be a filibuster from a home state senator over a judicial nominee. Okay, and so that practice gets put together, becomes procedural, redundant. 4 years, we have the cloture rule adopted by the Senate, but they don't undo the blue slip. They sort of forget about it, and it takes on institutional significance. So what we have today is a process in which both home state senators from a nominee's home state are sent a formal blue slip of paper asking them whether they support or oppose a nominee to either the circuit court or the federal district court or U.S. Marshal from within that state. Now, senators have three options when they get the blue slip. They can return it with a favorable recommendation, they can withhold it, or they can return it with a negative recommendation. And whether they withhold it or return it as a negative, they're both basically treated the same as saying, we don't support this nominee. Whatever purpose the blue slip originally had, it's basically lost that significance over time. So we have 1913 until 1956. What is it? It's just an indicator that a home state senator is miffed with a nomination, likely to not support it, maybe cause some headaches for the judiciary chair and maybe the Senate majority leader. 1956, James Eastland takes over, Democrat from Mississippi. He says anytime somebody submits a negative blue slip, it kills that nomination. It's not moving any further. Right, 1979, Ted Kennedy takes over, and he and President Carter want to expand the pool of folks in the federal judiciary, so they start ignoring negative blue slips a little bit more. So we're not going to treat them the same way we did. And so here's what we've seen over and over and over again since that time, when you've got divided government. Senate judiciary chairs are maybe a little bit more deferential to the blue slip, and when you've got unified government, they're a little bit less deferential to it. Okay. But here are sort of the undeniable facts about the blue slip today. Number one, they tend to occur in private, so you can't see which senators are blocking nominees unless they say so publicly. So this gives them an excellent institutional opportunity to kill nominations without having to do so publicly. They can kill a nomination for ideological reasons without having to come out in the public and say so. And that's precisely what we've seen. So they take place in private. And therefore, we don't really have a whole lot of access to the data on which senators blue slip and the conditions under which they do so. Aha! But for four Congresses, we were able to get those data. All right? So my co-authors and I collected all of the blue slip data from 2001 to 2009. Those are the only available data on blue slips that you can get prior to like the 1940s, and we don't really care about that. Okay? Here's what we found. For district court nominees during that time period, senators were much more likely to blue slip nominees who were ideologically distant from them. That shouldn't be a huge surprise in this day and age. But it turned out that high qualifications could, at least to some degree, resurrect your chances of getting through. Right? So you were still less likely to get that senator's approval. But if you were highly qualified, the senator would kind of cut you a break. Right? I suspect that's no longer the case in the last couple of years. However, this is unmistakably true, that for circuit court nominees, your qualifications no longer matter. Okay? All that matters is how ideologically close or distant you are from the senator, from your home state senator. If you're ideologically distant, they're going to try to kill your nomination. Right? So we hear a lot about blue slipping these days. Senator Baldwin withheld her blue slip recently for a nominee. David Strauss had his nomination potentially held up. Okay, the reason is it's all about ideology. And so the question that many people have is it time to get rid of the blue slip? The data that we've put together that are in some of the packet of information that you've seen for today, the data suggests the answer is absolutely yes, that whatever merit blue slips had, at least for the circuit court at one point in time, they no longer have any merit whatsoever. It's all about ideology.
Carrie, could you maybe react to Ryan's points, but also talk about some of the reforms that you've looked at in this process?
Sure. Yeah, the blue slip is one that, as Ryan pointed out, we didn't used to have a lot of information on exactly what was even going on. I'll let you know that there's one positive thing we've seen is now I've started on Bench Memos, which is a National Review Online blog, putting a judicial nominations update to try to give a little light of day on the blue slips. So I'll actually indicate on that whether blue slips have been returned on nominees. So it's something that didn't used to be public, and now we're trying to make it a little more obvious so people actually have to answer for the fact that they're trying to hold up nominations. I think the only other comment I would have is I absolutely agree. I think I'm happy with what Senator Grassley has been doing in terms of being willing to move forward on nominations when something that was supposed to be a tool for just giving some more input from home state senators has been used as a single senator veto. Never was supposed to be that. But I would just simply say that doesn't necessarily mean we have to even call it getting rid of the blue slip. The blue slip has never been, except for the very rare cases during Leahy and during Eastland's tenure, it really wasn't supposed to be a single senator veto. So when Democrats claim that they're getting rid of the blue slip, this is changing. Actually, no, this is not a different procedure than what has been done for the vast majority of the history of the blue slip. It's been different under every single Senate Judiciary Committee chair, so to pretend that this is somehow breaking with any kind of tradition is, I think, contrary to history. But the other comment I would have is that in terms of the holdup on judges, another area that we've seen that is now getting a lot more attention lately is the cloture process. So another formerly obscure procedural technique in the Senate that now is getting the light of day, really because the Senate Democrats have been weaponizing it to slow down nominations. This is the same thing we saw happen with the filibuster. It used to be that the concept of filibustering a judge was absolutely horrifying. No one would have thought that was what filibusters were for. As evidence, I submit that Justice Clarence Thomas had only 52 votes in his favor during obviously a very contentious confirmation process. If the Senate Democrats had thought that filibustering was a thing, it was something we would do to block a controversial nominee, for goodness sake, they would have done it for Clarence Thomas. They didn't. It had never been used in history as a partisan opposition to a judge until 2003, when the Senate Democrats started using it to block President Bush's nominees. And now that the filibuster is not available any longer, thanks to Harry Reid getting rid of it in 2013, and then the final nail in the coffin was getting rid of it for Supreme Court justices this past year, now that that's not available, they have to find some other way to block judges, knowing that they don't have the votes to do it. That the judges, that President Trump, for even people who I think disagree with him, can acknowledge that his judicial picks have been excellent. He has, especially at the circuit court level, some really outstanding nominees from the state Supreme Courts, from academia, from some of the leading appellate litigators. So these are people who have majority support. It's the Democrats are trying to find ways to block, slow down anything they can. One of them is the cloture process. So cloture used to be used to a vote to end debate, and that was really to block a filibuster. What's happening now is instead of having a vote to end debate and move on, because there's an actual filibuster being attempted or there's real debate going on, they are refusing to move on through unanimous consent on virtually every single judicial nomination. This used to be something that was really only required if you had someone controversial there was debate about. Now it's every single nomination, and the problem is that triggers up to 30 hours of debate on the floor for each nominee, and that has to go basically single file line of nominees then. And what's even worse is the executive calendar is both executive nominees and judicial nominees, so it requires all these nominations that are being held up to work their way into this incredible bottleneck of the cloture process. So what we've seen is the cloture being used for nominees, even nominees that are absolutely uncontroversial. You have nominees like David Nye, who was a former Obama district court nominee who had literally 100 votes in the Senate. And instead of allowing there just to be a voice vote and move on, which is what they would have done in every single other administration in history, they said, no, we need to have cloture. We need to run out the clock on this guy. You're not seeing actual debate happening during those 30 hours. It's rare that they even talk about the judge at all, especially because, as I said, so many of these are people who have upwards of 90 votes. Obviously, not all of them are, but, you know, for those people, they're just spending time. They might talk about something else. You might have open mic night at C-SPAN. It's not actually time to debate someone who is literally has no opposition to them. So the good news is Senator Lankford of Oklahoma has a proposal that just made it out of the Senate Rules Committee, and that would limit the time post cloture vote. This is something, it's very much similar to a bipartisan agreement that was done in 2013 for the end of Obama's term. Yeah, that was a temporary agreement, but it had majorities of the Democrat and Republican senators in favor of it, and that limited post-cloture debate, left it at 30 hours for circuit court nominees, for cabinet-level officials, for the Supreme Court, but said, for district court nominees, 2 hours. That's good enough. And frankly, that's way more than they've actually spent talking about the nominee in any of these cases. And then for the mid-level executive positions, it's 8 hours. I think that'd be a great common-sense solution. Whether you can get 60 senators to agree on it, or even 51 if they decide to use the constitutional option, the nuclear option, to change the rules, I think will be another question, but it's really shameful the amount of opposition that's been put up to these nominees. It's a large portion of the reason that we're seeing, I mean, the numbers are striking, with ballooning numbers of vacancies. When Trump came into office, there were 108 vacancies. Now there are 180. And we have confirmed 30, but yet somehow we've gone up 70 nominees. So that's basically 100 vacancies being created in the time that you had to confirm 30 of them. Those are unsustainable numbers. You don't have to be a math whiz to figure out that you can't have more vacancies at the end of the year and actually, you know, be able to gain any ground in the courts. So let alone, you know, not even grain ground, simply keep up with the vacancies. So I'm hopeful that something like that will perhaps gain some momentum simply because we can't keep on having more vacancies than at the end of the year than at the beginning.
With the context of the discussion on the blue slip and the issues we've seen really in Wisconsin, Judge Brennan not making it through the commission, but being appointed and hopefully confirmed by the Senate next couple of weeks. We have somebody who did make it through the commission, and then the U.S. Senator used the blue slip process to that person's detriment. Are these suggestions that we have just an off year with the Federal Nominating Commission here in Wisconsin, or is it indicative that we need some perhaps reform on the state side with the nominating process? Maybe Ryan or Carrie or Katie?
Well, I guess I think the first thing to point out is just the fact of having a nominating commission to select circuit court judges is somewhat unusual in and of itself. Many states, the senators will get together and they'll have a nominating commission to help them with their district court positions. But that's not all that common to begin with. And among those states that have nominating commissions, it's not all that common to have them actually get involved with the circuit courts either. So I think the first point to raise is just that our nomination commission is highly unusual just as itself. I suspect that in many of these commissions, they're also not evenly split because a 3-3 or a 2-2 just isn't going to work anymore. I suspect that it is probably time to reform that somehow or another. I don't know how you do that. Maybe you stack it, stack the commission according to your party's strength in the Senate, so you have a proportionate number there. I don't know, but I do think that we've gone a few vacancies now for the Seventh Circuit position, and it hasn't really worked out particularly well. I think you could make the argument that it's time for maybe a different structure.
I would just point out that the idea of a state having a nominated commission at all is clearly not the constitutional, it's not in the Constitution. It's not, obviously, each state can do it how they want, but this is something the idea that the senators would have outsized impact on the judges is one that's of tradition and not inherent in the way that system is set up. It makes more sense in the context of a district court judge to say the senators know their local legal community. They also have a lot more, the state, the court is entirely located within the state. However, to have the Wisconsin senators or the Illinois senators, the Indiana senators have disproportionate impact on judges that are going to hear cases from the entire circuit, it doesn't make nearly as much sense. That's particularly why the blue slip, for example, is less powerful and less used as a veto, I suppose, in the circuit court level than at the district court as well, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to have those senators, even less so to have kind of a secondary commission which is mostly invisible to the public, not really accountable to anyone, having a lot of pull on it's something that really is ultimately the president's decision. This is the nomination of judges is something the Constitution gives to the president. So will he take advice and input from the senators? Absolutely. And he's been doing that throughout with both Republican and Democratic senators. But it's not really their job to make the nomination. It's ultimately the president's job to make the nomination. So it's a little getting the cart before the horse, Tim.
And I do think one point actually should be made, too, is that for a senator to submit a blue slip after someone has come out of a commission with a positive vote is unheard of. And that has happened recently. So that is highly, highly unusual.
Katie, could we maybe turn to the state and the governor's role in the appointment process and the system and process that he uses?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So as Andrew mentioned, I'm the governor's chief counsel. Part of my role is to run the appointment process when there are judicial vacancies. Vacancies in Wisconsin occur due to unfortunately due to death, more commonly due to resignation or other similar occurrences as defined in statute. So when we do have a vacancy, as you all probably know, judges are regularly elected in the state, but when we do have midterm vacancies, the authority is on the governor to appoint a replacement at Supreme Court, appellate, and the circuit court, trial court level. We have a three-step process that we use. We use a judicial selection committee, which Andrew chairs, and Judge Brennan formerly chaired. That committee is made up of about 10 members from kind of different geographical regions in the state and also different practice areas. That committee, so for, we put out an application for about 2 to 4 weeks, and then we lean heavily on our committee to kind of do the vetting. So that our committee will utilize their contacts throughout the state and the practice area to ascertain the applicant's reputation in their community, in their legal community. We will do extensive discussions with references, you know, everyone from law enforcement to the current judges, the outgoing judge in the community, really anyone that's relevant that will speak to us. We'll usually pick up the phone and have a conversation with them. We look over the applicant's publications, writing samples. We talk extensively about their practice experience. And the committee does a very thorough job, and Andrew does, you know, a very thorough job of vetting applicants and then making recommendations to the office, where I step in. We have a second round interview panel in our office. That second round interview usually ends up being a lot of fun. We get to dive into philosophy and all sorts of fun topics like statutory interpretation, which I will dig into a little more deeply later in our panel here. The governor has said from the beginning of his first term that he has three criteria that he looks for when he appoints judges. Those criteria are integrity, competence, he wants an outstanding attorney, and judicial philosophy. So the entire appointment process is really designed around ascertaining which candidate best exhibits those three criteria. The governor himself conducts the final interviews. He touches on many of the points from the prior rounds and overall just, you know, likes to get to know the person, likes to see how they match up to those three criteria. We perform, you know, extensive background checks to make sure that this is somewhat of integrity. I will say that, you know, if you're interested in applying in the process, just because there may be, you know, something in your past doesn't mean that you necessarily can't get an appointment, but we look for people that are upfront and honest with us about, you know, about potential background check issues. And we also just want to know that you're someone of character and that there's really no questions remaining as to how you know, how someone would conduct themselves in that role. So we have a pretty thorough process. The process matters a lot to Governor Walker. I will say that judicial appointments are extremely important to him. He knows that they are part of his legacy that will long outlast his tenure, the tenure of, you know, some of the policies. Judges are there for, you know, hopefully a long time, and he takes it very seriously. He reads, you know, every word of the applications. He spends a long time thinking about these things and talking about them. So they're really eminently an important part of his job as governor, and he takes that very seriously, and we try to have a thorough and detailed process to get the best applicants that we can. I'll also say, if you're here and you're thinking of applying in the future, I think there are a number of things you can do to position yourself well to be a strong contender for an appointment in the future. For one, I would say do a great job where you're at now. The best thing you can do is be a really good attorney and to be well respected in your field and in your community. Like I said, we talked to references, listed and unlisted, and some of the most influential references are typically the outgoing judge and other sitting judges in the community. So just being a really good attorney, being well respected in your legal community. A lot of our good judges come from being leaders in the community. So, you know, both on the legal side, doing pro bono work, being involved in organizations like the Federalist Society, and just general volunteer work are just good things to do in general, but also help position yourself to be a strong contender if you're interested in a judicial appointment. You want to look for ways to build your credentials. Build your credentials, obviously. You know, look for opportunities to teach, to publish, and establish a presence in your field. You know, Rotary, volunteering, even with high school sports teams, churches, things like that are all things that just help you kind of get out in your community. So I'm always happy to talk in more detail if you're interested, but I think that we have a very good process. We've turned out a lot of wonderful candidates, some of which are here today. And I think we have a lot of good work that we've done and good work to do going forward, hopefully, as well.
Yeah, there's a number of people in the audience who've been through the process, mm-hmm. which is great. Let's turn a little bit to the candidates that have resulted from either a state process or a federal process. Carrie, could you talk a little bit about who the president has nominated, the types of people, background, judicial philosophies, please?
Yep. So the president has, his priorities for the circuit judge positions in particular, because as I said, this is where the president has even more sway than something like a district court, where there's traditionally a little bit more deference to the senators if they have someone who they think is the ideal pick. They're really the same criteria that we saw him talk about in reference to his Supreme Court shortlist. So this is someone who has a principled judicial philosophy. It would be looking at the original meaning of the Constitution, taking very seriously the text of the laws that they're tasked with interpreting, and someone that has a clear record of having done this. So that's something that I think you've seen, and we're going to talk about this as well, but not all presidents have viewed that as a plus necessarily. Sometimes it was almost seen as a, hey, we're looking for someone who doesn't have a record because then we can sneak them in. The problem with someone that doesn't have a record is you don't actually know what they really mm-hmm. think. And many people, when they're in that meeting with the judicial vetters, they know what you want to hear, and so they're happy mm-hmm. to tell you. What you want ideally is someone who has actually had the opportunity where the rubber meets the road to make tough decisions and to apply those things. So you know that they don't simply say, oh, well, I have read these articles about originalism, but they know how to do it. I haven't just know that this is what they want to hear, but I actually have had to deal with these issues in real life and have come to these conclusions on a principled ground. And in particular, someone that's not going to be substituting his or her own politics for the result. It's always, of course, as a judge, the goal is for the result to be dictated by the law that was passed by our elected representatives, not by the judges themselves. And so those are all things that this president is looking for. We've seen in his appellate nominees so far a real broad range of backgrounds. I mentioned that he has a lot of state Supreme Court judges. That's something that both for the circuit courts and on his Supreme Court shortlist that I applaud as an area that often got overlooked by other presidents, that there's people who have great judicial records. And it's also a very useful way to assess someone's actual judicial philosophy when they're on a state court of last resort, because you're not seeing simply how they're behaving when governed by precedent, but there are also opportunities at state Supreme Courts to make some of those final decisions and themselves. So we've got people like Justice Britt Grant now in the 11th Circuit, Allison Aid on the 10th Circuit from the Supreme Court of Colorado, David Strauss from the Supreme Court of Minnesota, Joan Larson from the Supreme Court of Michigan. So a lot of those type of people. We also have seen district court judges that have been advanced, like Amy St. Eve in the 7th Circuit here, and then Amul Thapar in the 6th Circuit, as well as a lot of academics. And that's another area where you could maybe get a better sense. It's of someone who's written a lot and explaining their own philosophy. So someone like Amy Coney Barrett is someone who has a extensive academic background. Actually, some of those state Supreme Court judges also have academic backgrounds too, Joan Larson, David Strauss, et cetera. I think the other thing that's interesting to note about the appellate judges is that these are people who have a similar principled approach to the law, but that doesn't always mean they're going to come to the same conclusions. And that's something, the Fifth Circuit recently had a campaign finance case where Judge Ho and Judge Willett, both Trump appointees, came to opposite conclusions. And it's not because one of them was a hack and the other one wasn't. It was because they both are applying these principles and sometimes coming to different conclusions. And as Federalist Society members, you are familiar with this. The Federalist Society has people who agree on some broad principles but disagree on pretty much everything else. And so that we can have some really good debates. And when you go to the conferences, you'll always find lots of topics that you can approach from more than one perspective. So it certainly doesn't dictate the outcome. A case at the Supreme Court case that came down recently, the Sessions versus DiMaia case, where Justice Gorsuch came to an opposite conclusion from the other four conservative members of the court, raised a lot of eyebrows, but I think it was just an example of the same thing, of just because you have, he was coming to the result he did from very clear originalist perspective, as well as following precedent that Justice Scalia himself had set. And that doesn't mean that the other side, wasn't. They were operating under similar principles. They just come to different conclusions. So anyway, I think it's been a fascinating field, and they've got a lot of diversity of background as well as even their own approach to certain cases.
Carrie and Katie, first, I'm wondering if the issue of judicial engagement versus judicial restraint is an emerging discussion in the appointment process. And then maybe, Ryan, if you could follow up with, should it be? So Katie or Carrie.
From my perspective, I think that's something that gets a lot of discussion, in people commenting on the courts. But I think that sometimes both sides are a little bit caricaturing the other. I don't think anyone thinks that my bigger concern is almost not judicial engagement or restraint, but someone who's dodging the hard questions and someone who's willing to grapple with them and answer them. So some of the concerns, I feel like something like a Chief Justice Roberts approach to judicial restraint, I think maybe what is part of what triggered this debate of, oh, well, we shouldn't try to jump in here. From my perspective, something like, for example, the Obamacare decision, which is probably the one that he gets the most flack for, my concern about that wouldn't be is this a judicial restraint versus judicial engagement? Can I find a way not to solve a difficult question versus I'm the judge, I have to make the call because this question came to me. And so that is the kind of concern that I think you would have. And this is, again, where examples of someone in their practice before, in their career, taking tough questions and answering them and not simply trying to maybe create the carefully curated record that once might have been considered what you need to get on the court. I think it's a good sign that people who are willing to say, step up as a judge or even as a practitioner and say, you know what, this isn't someone that's going to win me fans on one side of the aisle or the other, but I think this is the right legal answer and I'm going to go with that. I think that's almost the more important question. Are they willing to step up and make those calls? But that's my question.
Yeah, I would echo that. I would say, by and large, what we're looking for is thoughtful analysis and an ability to dialogue about these concepts, right? That's being able to talk about things like judicial engagement, judicial restraint are especially important at the Supreme Court and appellate court levels, at the circuit court, and sometimes especially in kind of more of the rural communities. It's spectacular if we have candidates that can dive deeply on those concepts, but really what I'm looking for is, are you familiar with those concepts? Are you able to talk, with some level of competence about the key cases on the concepts? And if you can engage in, a dialogue about what your opinion is, what that means, what does judicial engagement mean to you? If you like it, great. Why? Can you acknowledge some of the pros and cons of each theory? And are you able to explain what cases support that, what cases don't support it, and why you believe that is the right philosophy?
Yeah, so I like that question, and I like the answers so far, the non-dodging and the answering with clarity. So, in anticipation of this question, I went and grabbed a handful of opinions from some of our Federalist Society members who have now sat on the state Supreme Court. So I'm looking at you, Justice Kelly, Justice Bradley. I grabbed some of their opinions over the last week and read through them. And there are a few things that stood out about their opinions, which I think are spectacular, all right? Two things in particular. Well, three. Let's go with your non-dodging. First is they're not afraid to answer some of these major constitutional questions, right? I mean, I had a conversation recently with somebody who was talking about the Tea Party and, what value did they really serve? I said, well, look, I don't care if you think they were politically viable or not. They did bring us back to first principles, right? They got us talking about constitutional first principles. Well, it's kind of the same thing here, right? We're sort of returning to first principles, right? Not dodging. So I like that. The opinions are clear. Okay, and third, they talk about the value of the separation of powers, but not in a way that many judges do, right? So many judges will write an opinion that talks about the separation of powers, how great it is, and we all laud James Madison, and then, then we go away, That's not what they do in their opinions. So take, for example, Gabler versus Crime Victims Rights Board. This is an opinion by Justice Bradley. The question in the case was whether or not the Crime Victims Rights Board had the authority essentially to punish judges for some of their decisions on the court, right? It's a little bit more nuanced than that, but not much, okay? Justice Bradley's opinion goes through a discussion about the separation of powers, how this violates the separation of powers, but then goes on to talk about why that's important, okay? And so let me quote this portion of it here for you. She writes, "If the judiciary passively permits another branch to arrogate judicial power unto itself, however estimable the professed purpose for asserting this prerogative, the people inevitably suffer. If the power to perform judicial duties is subject to formal penalties imposed under color of law by another branch of government, the people lose their independence. Lose their independent arbiters of the law, the balance of power tips, and the Republican form of government is lost." Okay? That goes far beyond just talking about the separation of powers as this abstract concept, but rather tells us why we should care about the separation of powers. It's a return to first principles. It's an explanation for why we should care about some of these things. Justice Kelly as well has some excellent writing here. The recent case about the gun concealed carry in Madison and whether buses in the city of Madison can preclude people from carrying their firearms. It's a very interesting, well-written opinion. But towards the end of it, he says this, "To rule otherwise would be lawmaking as comedy, with a hapless legislature chasing about a wily municipality," I like that, a wily municipality, "as it first enacts an ordinance on a forbidden subject, and then a policy, and then a rule, right? Then a standard, and on and on and on until one of them wearies of the pursuit or the other exhausts the thesaurus," right? What was this? It was a discussion on his part and the court's part about why formalism matters, why structure matters. We can't just give something a label and then let people off the hook. We have to really look into it and write clearly and decisively on these topics. And so I think if there's anything we can take from some of their jurisprudence in recent years, it is that, an ability not to dodge, an ability to write clearly, and an ability and perhaps an eagerness, depending on who you may talk to, about deciding these tough questions. And I think that's fantastic.
Turning back to the federal appointments, Carrie, maybe if you could talk to us a little bit of compare President Trump's nominees with previous nominees from former presidents.
Yeah, I think I alluded to this earlier. I think the biggest thing to note is that from my perspective is a great thing that President Trump doesn't view having taken positions that he knows are going to excite opposition as a necessarily disqualifying factor. So if you take some of the recent nominees that we've seen, for example, Kyle Duncan, who was one of the most recently confirmed, he was clearly an outstanding lawyer. He had been the state's first solicitor general. He had argued in multiple cases at the Supreme Court. But he was former general counsel of the Beckett Fund during the Hobby Lobby case. That was one of the cases. He didn't argue that one, but brought to the Supreme Court. Definitely a third rail issue. He had helped defend his state's, Louisiana's, marriage laws. That is a third rail issue. And once upon a time, regardless of how good a lawyer you were, those would be the kind of things that might be considered disqualifying. That's not so under the Trump administration. I think partly because they knew that someone who has the courage and to stand up for what they think is the correct legal result and to do it in a way that's not putting their own ambition over the legal realities there or simply just standing up for what they believe in, actually is an asset, someone who's not letting that stop them. Now, this doesn't mean that someone who's a plain old corporate lawyer is someone who's not eligible, but I just think it's exciting to see that's something that doesn't eliminate you. So there's a lot of more opportunities, and it's that people are encouraged now seeing, hey, this is someone who was willing to put the money where their mouth was and actually spend their time making these arguments. I think in some ways the now even more extreme partisan nature in the Senate
almost is freeing. First, on one side, Trump is more excited about nominations than probably many other presidents, partly because he saw during his run for the White House the impact of a judicial nomination, because Justice Scalia's vacancy was staring everyone in the face. He knew that every time he went and gave a rally, that when he said, I'm going to appoint justices in the mold of Justice Scalia, people stood up and clapped. And so that was something that most presidential candidates didn't get that reminder of. So I think he realizes for that reason this is a top priority. And Don McGahn has been excellent in terms of the White House counsel's office in also seeing this as a big priority. But I think also on the Senate side, we've gotten to a point once upon a time where you know, middle of the road candidates would be almost overwhelmingly approved, where they would get voice voted in. You know, I think President Kennedy had only one nominee who ever had any votes against them. They just didn't even take voice votes on any of them. So nowadays, if you had like, for example, Justice Thomas's 52 vote squeak by confirmation, that looks bad. Nowadays, that's just what everyone gets. You could be, you know, a cross between Oliver Wendell Holmes and John Marshall, and you would get 51 votes or 50 votes nowadays with Senator McCain out there if you're nominated by President Trump. So that allows them to not think, oh gosh, it's going to look bad maybe if this is someone that ignites some partisan opposition. It doesn't matter. Everyone gets partisan opposition. They've cried wolf so many times that it actually makes it a little easier to say, you know what? That's all right. We're going to swing for the fences now and not have to worry about trying to find people that have that are kind of secret, closeted conservative nominees. We can just say, hey, you know, we know this person, where this person stands, but that's okay. They're an excellent lawyer and they'll be an excellent judge. So I think that's something that's very exciting.
Thank you. Katie, who is Governor Walker appointed? Could you break it down for us, not only the numbers, but also the philosophy?
Indeed. I do have some numbers here. So since the governor took office in early 2011, he has made 91 total judicial appointments, two of which were just yesterday. 25 of these have been women, which is proportionally and just in terms of raw numbers higher than Governors Doyle and Thompson. Looking at the current statewide bench, the governor has appointed 25% of all sitting circuit court judges, almost 40% of court of appeals judges, and 2 out of 7 of our Supreme Court justices. So overall, about a quarter of the current sitting judges at 33 levels have been appointed by the governor. Turning to philosophy and what the governor looks for, I know earlier I mentioned he has his 3 criteria: integrity, legal competence, and judicial philosophy. Diving into philosophy, you know, I think it's no surprise it'll echo much of what's been said. On the panel, the governor's looking for originalist, textualist judges. I will say that probably all but a handful of candidates have walked into the interview using the right buzzwords, right, and saying, you know, rule of law, separation of powers, Justice Scalia. But our goal is really to dig deeply to discern whether or not an applicant really has thought deeply about these things and has a thoughtful, coherent judicial philosophy and a framework for applying that philosophy. I think the ability to articulate a philosophy and to distinguish between different philosophies is indicative of a judge who's, or a candidate rather, who's well-prepared, well-read, and able to analyze complex issues, which itself is a skill that is very important for judges, not only at the Supreme and Appellate Court levels, but also at the trial court level. So, you know, I think a sound judicial philosophy starts with first principles, as has been set up here. You know, understanding the principles upon which this country was founded, especially as it relates to liberty interests and private property rights, separation of powers, both kind of vertical and horizontal separation of powers. Again, we hear that term a lot, but does the candidate really understand the proper relationship between the states and the federal government when it comes to matters of regulations and individual rights? What does it mean when you say the legislature makes the laws and the judicial branch is the interpreter? Might this be someone who becomes frustrated with the sometimes slow-moving pace of the legislature and sees their judicial opinions as a mechanism to move the law in one way or another to keep pace with the times, so to speak? Or as Judge Posner called it, judicial interpretive updating, right? Does their language dictate that they might do that? Or do they understand and respect the limited role of the judge? A judge who understands separation of powers, I think, also needs to recognize limits on executive branch agency regulatory authority. Yes, I work in the executive branch, and I formerly worked actually writing regulations, so I definitely understand the importance of needing judges who are willing and able to enforce statutory protections on agency rulemaking, and that understand that agencies only have the power to write policies insofar as that power is explicitly delegated in statute. And when rules are created, that they're created through notice and comment procedures that provide due process to the citizens that are regulated by them. When it comes to statutory interpretation, we want judges who know what to do when they encounter an ambiguous statute. So are they able to use well-recognized canons of interpretation? Or are they someone who might be quick to declare a statute as vague or ambiguous in order to open up the floodgates of external sources to support any number of wide interpretations and pick the one that gets the desired result, right? We're looking for people who have thought through these things, who are able to, who are able to have a discussion, able to walk through some examples for us, and who, you know, to whom fidelity to the text is paramount. We've talked about outcome-based judges. At the federal level, we also, you know, are mindful of not selecting someone, hopefully, that will be an outcome-based judge. We look for people who can talk about cases. We ask applicants what's maybe your, you know, couple of your favorite cases and your least favorite cases, and we look for whether or not they can dialogue about cases using legal principles and the language of legal reasoning as opposed to outcome. So if we have someone sitting before us who's a prosecutor, I ask myself, are they able to, you know, do they pick their favorite cases based on whether it resulted in a conviction or resulted in standards that are more law enforcement friendly, or are they able to move beyond just the outcome of the case and actually talk about the legal principles and legal reasoning used in the case? Someone who's especially thoughtful on this point may even be able to talk about a case in which they disagree with the outcome, but explain why that case is, you know, a matter of sound legal reasoning and, you know, good for the overall cause of the rule of law. I tend to be leery of language that indicates that one's desire for a fair and just outcome in a case may outweigh one's commitment to performing a truly objective textualist analysis. I think, you know, while we can all agree that moral convictions generally are a very good thing, and our judges, we want to know that one can kind of put those personal convictions or preferences aside and just ensure that their ability to be a neutral arbiter of the law is not clouded by personal judgments or moral convictions. We want candidates who understand and adhere to an originalist interpretation of the Constitution. I think this is important. Even at the trial court level, sometimes we get candidates who say, okay, come on, I'm applying to be a circuit court judge, trial level, I'm not dealing with the Constitution every day, I'm not, you know, interpreting statutes that are ambiguous without clear precedent telling me what to do, so why are we even having this conversation? But I think that view fails to fully appreciate the importance of judges who have thought deeply about these things and are able to analyze philosophies and just, you know, by and large, I think it's important to recognize that the Constitution is relevant and authoritative, and just because it was written before modern technology and cars and cell phones does not mean that it cannot or should not be applied faithfully. And if you're, you know, wondering how to do that, there is lots of literature out there. Reading Law by Scalia and Gardner is one of them that really walks through how that can be. So, you know, I think it's short-sighted to give short shrift to the plain meaning of the words of the Constitution, and we look for language that kind of indicates which way a person might go on that. And I'll just end by saying these interviews are not political litmus tests, right? Just because we're talking about judicial philosophy, it's very different from political philosophy. The governor says all the time he would have no problem and does have no problem appointing someone who may have different policy views or political views from himself, so long as there's someone who can put those views aside and adhere to the judicial principles that we're speaking about. And so I think, you know, coming full circle, I go back to the first criteria I mentioned, which is integrity. It takes someone of integrity to be able to put your personal views aside and stick to rule of law principles. And I'll end with a Justice Scalia quote that says, "The honest originalist will sometimes or often reach results that he does not personally favor." So what we're looking for in the interviews, I think, is really someone who understands what that means and really believes it and could do that in practice. I think we've been successful at doing that so far, seeing many of you in the room, and that's what we're looking for going forward.
So I think we'll, in a minute, turn to questions. If any of you or all of you have closing comments, honestly, we didn't really talk about that when we did our preparation, so I'm throwing them kind of into the fire here. It's okay if you don't, but if there's closing comments, we'll work our way down the line. Carrie, I guess you drew the short straw by sitting next to me.
Yeah, you know, I think we've said a lot of what there is to be said. I want one thing that just occurs to me. I want to maybe a footnote to my comments. I don't want to suggest that the previous presidents have not had the right focus on judges in terms of this textualism, originalism. I just am very happy to see a president that is a little less worried about finding people who will, sneak under the radar. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't every nominee by President Bush either. But it, mm-hmm. but I think it's kind of that's not even part of the scheme anymore. Partly because. No one's under the radar anymore. Everyone's going to get attacked. So.
Certainly there were some in the past that didn't focus on those things, though.
Well, there have been some.
No, I'm fine.
Just piggybacking on, Carrie's point about the judges that the president is appointing. I'll just say from the state perspective, it's encouraging to see this president appointing judges who understand kind of proper limits on the role of the federal government and the federal judiciary. From my chair, I see just with the ever-increasing scope of federal programs, conditions on funding, et cetera, it seems that the federal government's really got their tentacles in just about everything that we deal with at the state level. And so it's encouraging to see judges on the federal, being appointed to the federal bench, who understand appropriate limits on their power, understand appropriate limits on the power of the federal government, and are willing to enforce those limits, and even when it may be politically unpopular.
Great. So I can see questions going one of two ways. None. because I want to come up and talk to these people just quietly, or potentially a lot. We hope that this is helpful for folks who want to become a judge, and insightful, even if you don't, it's insightful to pass it on. The governor, I think the president too, very focused on building up the farm team of judges, credentialing young lawyers properly, getting them plugged into the right things, and then moving them up through the process. So hopefully this was helpful. If there are questions, we would welcome them. Thank you, Jordan.
Thank you all for coming here. I would have a question for Carrie, my good friend, Steve. Her reputation, if you're not gathering, is like she's the all-knowing Yoda of all these things with the judicial appointments. What I'm curious about with the Lankford proposal of, shortening the time, do you think that's going to get passed? You kind of made it sound like it might not. So can the majority leader just simply say, okay, you want to filibuster, we're in session 24/7 here, and defeat it that way? And then I also wanted to ask about if there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court, there's the list of the 25. The president can stay in the 25. Is Don McGahn in the White House counsel's office really? It's like a list of like five or something like that.
Yeah, so in terms of the Lankford proposal, I hope it would pass. If it doesn't, though, there are still other options, and some of them have already been employed. So one thing that Leader McConnell has done effectively several times now is basically said, okay, guys, you've got to finish your homework before you leave for recess, effectively, and saying, okay, we all would love to leave on Thursday afternoon, which is what senators do. They work from, Monday afternoon to Thursday or so, and it's a job everyone would love to have. But they especially in an election year, would love to go home and talk to their constituents in their home states. If he says, we're going to get through X number of judges this week and we'll leave on Thursday or Friday or whenever we need to based on this time, in several cases, the Democrats, in fact, in every case, they've effectively yielded back sufficient time to get to their flights on Thursday afternoon. So that's one effective way of doing it. Now, I know there's some Senate Republicans who also want to get home to their districts. So I think that maybe is part of the pushback on doing that every single week. But I would be happy to see him do that with great frequency. It wouldn't be a bad thing for senators who are working you know, 4 full-day weeks or even 5-day weeks every once in a while, just because we have a huge backlog. And as I said, we've had almost twice as many vacancies as when Trump took office. It's kind of crazy. And that's not even talking about the administration, the Trump administration, which has got a lot of empty seats as well. If there's a Supreme Court vacancy, I do think he is going to stick to the list is my thing, first because he said he's going to do it, and second, last fall we saw that the president added a few names to his not-so-short list. That, to me, is an indicator that he views it as it's almost like an analogy to originalism. If you're going to change the Constitution, there's a method for doing it, and you amend it. Don't just make it up. And I think he seems that his method of changing the list isn't just to go off list when the time comes, but he actually amended the list and added some names to it. So that to me is evidence that, to the extent that he wants to change it, we're actually going to get notice of it. That's great from my perspective because it's a transparency thing, and it allows people to see what he really means when he talks about these judges. Now, I think in terms of how you know whether he secretly have a shorter list, I'm sure that they, having already gone through the process once, have people that they looked at more closely. There were famously maybe 5 people I think that got brought in to do interviews last time. I assume those are all people that are going to get another hard look, but I don't think that rules out any of the other people on the list of 25. So it's a long short list to be looking at, but it's a heck of a lot shorter than every lawyer in the country. So it's something.
You know, one thing to add on this, if there is a vacancy, right, so let's say Justice Kennedy retires or one of the others involuntarily leave, you can anticipate that I think President Trump would put somebody on the court in the shape of a Neil Gorsuch, at which point the swing justice on the Supreme Court becomes Chief Justice Roberts. And that will be the first time in modern history that the chief would also be the swing justice. You want to talk about having a powerful position on the court. Roberts would not only be the most senior, but if he's also the swing, he's going to have significant authority. So that's just something that I'm keeping my eye on if it happens.
Any other questions? Thanks, Tony.
This is kind of a parochial question. I'm a Dane County attorney. I've been doing litigation here for 40 years. And we seem to get a lot of appointed caretaker judges for obvious political reasons. Do you see any end to that, any way we get around that? Because, frankly, the judiciary in Dane County is suffering a lack of competence on some areas. If we could get competent attorneys appointed and reelected, I don't know what can we do about that?
I agree with that sentiment.
I gotta practice it.
We too like to appoint competent judges. Electorally, it's no surprise, Dane County is a difficult place. So while that's by no means one of the primary factors we look at, we do like our appointees to be able to be reelected in the counties that they're appointed. So there's no, you know, black and white policy that we have. We just kind of analyze case by case who applies. One of the challenges sometimes is just, you know, do we have enough applicants? Do we have an applicant that the governor is comfortable appointing? And if we don't, you know, then he's not afraid to leave a seat open if no one meets that criteria that I outlined. So it can be a challenge for us. We take it kind of case by case and hope we have good candidates and that they can be reelected. So I don't have a more thorough answer for you, but.
Well, I just wonder if there would be anybody out there willing to put the resources into backing a competent candidate and helping on the re-election such that they could be encouraged to take the appointment and run for re-election. Because, you know, there is one of the problems judges have is they have to put together a campaign network almost immediately after appointment to get re-elected. Now, in smaller counties, that's not a problem. They probably won't even have anybody running against them. In Dane County, of course, now they're a Walker appointee and they're a target.
Mm-hmm.
So,
we'll take checks at this, Tony. Okay. This table, Tony.
And I will leave before that happens.
All right. Thank you very much.